You're listening to the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Welcome to another episode of JX Outside. Joining me in the studio are our three resident outdoor guides, Nicole Larson. She loves horses, backcountry skiing, and mountain biking. She's a lifelong trail runner who grew up on Mount Ashland and now lives on a ranch in Northern California. Hi, Nicole.
Hi, good to see you.
Jennifer Bray is from Etna, California. She brings with her 26 years of experience in wildland fire in the Klamath Mountains. Hey, Jen.
Good morning. Good to be here.
And at some point, we're going to get Ray Pettengill in here. He's an avid mountain climber. He's climbed mountains all over the world, including Mount Shasta, more than 100 times. He's also known as Rogue Valley Ray, and he'll be joining us shortly. Today, we're also focusing on two major outdoor activities, foot racing and mountaineering. We're going to save the mountaineering for later with our special guest, Chris Carr, and he's right here. He's the owner of Shasta Mountain Guides.
Good morning.
Hey, Chris. For now, let's turn our attention to running. With the beautiful weather outdoors, more people are getting out there walking and running. And Nicole, I know you're an experienced runner. With summer approaching, what major races are on your radar for the month of June?
Well, to be honest, most of my time this year would be just people volunteering for some of these races. I've had my race years, and they were super great. But running for me has really turned into more meditative practice and time alone in the mountains. But what I can do, and what a lot of us can do, is volunteer. And it is a really good time to watch these families and serious runners come together and be a part of these races.
Well, Jen, you've done that as well?
I have. My favorite part is documenting it. So to take these pictures and share it with them, especially when they turn out good.
Okay, so people that don't get into the foot races, they can just volunteer.
They can volunteer, and it's really impressive to see these athletes.
Well, I know that the Mount Ashland Hill Climb on June 7th is a pretty big deal.
It's a big deal, which is already sold out. It's definitely worth training for if it's something you're interested in. It's a 5,600-foot gain, so over 13.5 miles of this elevation gain on trail and, you know, back roads and whatnot. It's a very popular local race.
Well, for those who have already missed it since it's sold out.
Yes.
What makes the Headwaters Trail Run on June 20th a unique challenge?
So Chris might be able to talk with this one too, because I know we both have spent much time on those trails. It's on trail. So running on the trail compared to road running is much different. You have to pay attention to what's in front of you. You know, you got to look ahead.
Does the footwear matter?
Footwear does matter. You know, what you're wearing, if you're running on road, you're going to wear road shoes. If you're running on trail, you're going to have trail shoes.
You want ankle support too, right? The ankle support of the trail running is super important.
Yeah, yeah. What do you think, Chris?
You know, the Headwaters Trail Run is such a great event for our area, and it really highlights the diversity of trails, but it's also one of the most rugged trail races, I think, in the West Coast. Our company's been a sponsor of the event, so I've worked at aid stations talking about volunteering.
Great.
And I've been inspired to do more running because of it. One of my goals, I thought I was going to be able to actually complete the run, but I'll be honest, at 50K, at 100K, it's... That ship has sailed.
Yeah. Do we have a lot of local runners that participate in that one?
There's a few. There's a handful every year that participate in the run. But it's also great, too, because there's different lengths. And this year, because of the Lake Siskiyou Trail just opened with the bridges around the Delta, so there's a 10K event, which actually I'm thinking about. That might be more in my wheelhouse.
Yeah, right.
It's a nice flat run around Lake Siskiyou, 10K, perfect for first-time competitors and all ages and abilities.
And are these events open to walkers? Do you have to run? Or if you get tired, can you take a little stroll?
I think you can walk a lot of them, but there sometimes are time limits, and that's just depends on each race.
Mm-hmm. I do know on the Headwaters, the main event, there are time limits.
That makes sense.
To sweep the course. It's a really rugged, long race, and you don't want people getting lost and getting, you know, after dark out there.
Well, that's for serious runners.
That's for serious folks who are training fairly, you know, consistently and regularly for that. Because of the vertical gain, the terrain's quite rugged, and it's long.
Well, I know that a common misconception is that running is only for fast competitors. Does a person need to be competitive to enjoy these trails, or is there a different personal reward that just comes from participating?
I would say there's definitely a personal reward for running in general. I would say it's probably one of the cheapest sports you can get into. Really, you just need a good pair of shoes and an outfit and the determination. And it's, you know, personal accountability, because when you first start running, it's going to be hard. It's going to be hard. It doesn't matter if you're just running 2 miles down to the local park or if you're going to try a trail. But give yourself a couple weeks and stay consistent. It's a proud moment. It's a proud moment when you get out there and you get that runner's high.
Well, I know the Lemurian Ascent Trail Run at Mount Shasta Ski Park is coming up on June 27th. Is it true that this event is for both seasoned professionals and first-time racers?
Yes, and that is the first for Shasta Ski Park putting on a running race, which I think is great. It's a great location, great way to diversify their area for many different sports. And they are saying this is a family-friendly event. Obviously, there's a longer course also for the more seasoned runner.
Well, for listeners that are looking for a more family-friendly or beginner pace, what activities are coming up this month for them?
Well, we have the Turtle Trot locally here in Ashland, and that's on the 6th. And that is super family-friendly, which is great. So you can show up with strollers and little kids and, you know, your 11, 12-year-olds who are feeling really ambitious. Also, there's one in Reading, and that's along the River Trail. And the great thing about that one is that I feel like a handicap situation, if you're, you know, coming along with a wheelchair or any sort of disabilities, it's a great one to be a part of as well.
Okay, well, you're listening to JX Outside on the Jefferson Exchange. Our resident outdoor guides are Nicole Larson, Jen Bray, and we're missing Ray Pettengill at the moment. Nicole, what do you personally like about running?
I mean, I would have to say when I first started running, it was really for, like, the athletic part, the speed, the adventure. Like in my 20s, I was like really into training and going for that. And then my 30s is more for performance and like really perfecting my time and my, you know, ability. And then it turned into balance. And now it's more about joy. I just like the joy of it. So I feel like running has changed for me over the seasons. And I don't take it as seriously as I did at one time. Now it's really truly just about being like far away in the woods, on a trail, sometimes alone, sometimes with friends. It really can just be whatever you want it to be.
How far do you usually run?
Well, in my day, I did long runs, you know, it was easily, you know, 8 to 10 miles, 5 days a week. I'm now a maintenance runner. I do, you know, 2.5 to 3 is great.
Okay, 2.5 to 3, that's maintenance?
I call that maintenance running now, yes.
Okay. Chris, you're a runner as well, right?
It might be a stretch to call me a runner. I'm trying to become more of a runner. And I think what I love about it is the simplicity. You know, lace up a pair of shoes, throw on a pair of shorts, and hit the trails, and you're good to go.
What about you, Jen?
I like the time to myself. You know, I work through things in my head. I like hitting those goals, you know, when you're not exhausted, when you hit that 5 mile mark or that 10 mile mark. I've done half marathons. That's the most I've done. But still, you have to play those mind games and one step farther. You can do one step farther.
Well, if someone wants to find a local community to run with probably year round, where should they look?
Oh, online is a great source. The Rogue Valley Runners, they're a big group. There's the Siskiyou Mountain Runners are in Shasta, right?
Yep. A lot of these you can find like through Facebook groups.
And a lot of them volunteer their time at some of these races. So I know the Siskiyou Mountain Runners would help us with the race that we organized in Etna. So they're willing to travel.
Okay, so the Siskiyou Mountain Runners, the Rogue Valley Runners.
And then there's one in Reading. I believe they're called Sweat.
Sweat?
Yeah. That's a proper
Which
name.
Which it is Reading. So Running and Reddings. Maybe it's an evening thing.
Well, for our listeners, if you know of a runner's club anywhere in Southern Oregon and Northern California or other outdoor activity clubs, let us know about them. Send an email to jx@jeffnet.org. Just be sure to put JX Outside in the subject line. Now, I know that there are some essential safety and comfort tips regarding gear, hydration, injury prevention for anyone that's hitting the trails and participating in foot racing this summer.
Yes. I mean, shoes, first of all, are the most important. You really only need shoes to be the most comfortable. So really buying the right kind of shoes for what kind of running you're doing.
And do socks matter? Because I hear about compression socks, but it feels like it's a personal choice.
I think it's a personal choice. Some runners use them for after and some use them during.
Are there health benefits for it?
Well, it is for circulation. So just as you could imagine, it's really a personal preference. Mm-hmm. And then they have the runner's vest, which, you know, you can have water, snacks, and whatnot. What a great invention, because it is really helpful.
Or the fanny pack. The fanny pack is very stylish.
It is very stylish. And safety tips, really, like being clear on where you're going and your plan, and let someone know. You know, I have had that happen where I'm out and I've sprained an ankle, and I all of a sudden my run became kind of a situation. How do I get home?
Well, if you're out in the woods, how do you know where these trails are going? Do you have a map?
It comes back to the know before you go thing, you know, and plan your route. And again, communicate with somebody knowing where you are. But to know the terrain, to know the elevation gain that you're going to get, and training for sure. But just all those details play into it.
Well, even if you have your cell phone, a lot of times if you're out somewhere, you might not have service.
This is true. I do love a couple of apps, you know, you can look at, and they will give you, you can download the map, and so you know where you are. It's a great way to keep on track.
So if you're going for, let's say, 5 miles, and you're going on a trail, you're going to be in wooded terrain, what do you take with you?
Water for sure. You might want some moleskin in case you get blisters. You can apply it to your foot, and it gives you that extra comfort for your blister areas.
I've never heard of moleskin.
Moleskin is a sticky, like a Band-Aid, but it has a soft outer, so it kind of just rubs on the moleskin instead of your skin.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good addition. Snacks for sure, like the goo. Gatorade has that goo that gives you a little boost of energy for the last parts of your run. And as far as the maps go, some of the maps that you download will give you a blue dot where you are on the map. And I think that's pretty important to be familiar with that before the run.
And any sunscreen or anything like that? I don't need it, but
a hat's great. Honestly, on a 5 mile run, I probably wouldn't take water. I probably would even take, you know, a goo. I would probably most likely take sure I have my key to my car, and I would have chapstick. There's something about having chapstick. If you're thirsty, you put that on. I can make it another 2 miles.
Okay, so you wouldn't even take water with you?
If it was a 5 mile run, probably not. If it's, you know, are we talking 8 miles? Yes, maybe I would consider. But even then, you become more seasoned over time as you're running. You start, you know, when you first start running, you'll start with a couple miles, and you build up, and your body builds up too. It knows how to conserve energy, and you hydrate before you go.
And how do you know what pace you should have?
That's just on, you know, that's just part of your training. You just start slow, and, you know, over time you get more excited and you look into different training techniques and you start sprinting, and it all ups your mileage and ups your time in your miles.
And speaking of hydration, should you just drink water the day, like the morning of the race, or should you do that a couple of days prior to actually show up?
If you want to stop hydrated constantly during the race, then yeah, the day of. But yeah, it's a couple of days. Like, really, you need to pre-plan, just like every sport you do.
Yeah.
And okay, in life.
So I know that if I'm going to take any of my family out into, you know, who knows where, first aid kits have to be part of, you know, what we take with us.
That's the bandana I've tied around my neck for an emergency. I mean, in your cars, don't we always have a first aid kit? I think on runs, that's what Chris even called it. It's just such a simple sport. You really don't need much. When it gets more serious over time, sure, you start to get more and more prepared. But if you just want to get out and start running, get yourself a pair of shoes, a pair of shorts, and you know, the excitement.
Now, you said that, one of you said that there's a difference between running on pavement, running on a track, running in trails.
Yes.
I don't know what kind of shoes I would need for any of those.
Well, there is a really nice local running store here in Ashland, and I would highly suggest checking them out. They're incredible helpers. They have group runs. They will talk to you about the shoes, talked about the kind of choices you want to be making and how long and what your training is going to look like. But it is really great to know the difference. And there are different types of races and running. You know, there's everything from a road race, you know, when you're on pavement. I think, Jen, you've been part of a half marathon. Is that correct?
Yes, it was brutal. It was all on pavement. There was no shade, and it was brutal. So I was grateful that I hydrated really well on the way, and I had the proper footwear.
Yeah, and then Chris mentioned, just like the race that's coming up, it's all on trail. And so there's a different kind of shoe just for that, kind of like mountain bike to road bike.
Okay, well, speaking of Chris, we're going to get to him in just a moment. We have to take a short break. You're listening to JX Outside on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. Our resident outdoor guides are Nicole Larson, Jennifer Bray, and we're missing Ray Pettengale today. We're excited, though, to welcome our special guest, Chris Carr, owner of Shasta Mountain Guides. He joins us here in the studio. Chris, before the break, we were talking about all this running, and I understand you're training for a marathon.
Well, I'm training for a half marathon, a trail marathon, about a 15-mile trail run in our area on the Pacific Crest Trail, as a matter of fact. So it's relatively new to me, but running is a great training tool for mountaineering, and really proper preparation for mountaineering is essential. And however you train, it needs to be consistent and very dedicated, and running is a great training tool for the activity of climbing mountains.
Well, as owner of Shasta Mountain Guides, is June the official start of the season for you, or is mountaineering a year-round activity?
It can be a year-round activity, but the peak climbing season on Mount Shasta is typically spring and summer. So we essentially say May 1st is the start of our busy season. We'll hold our guide training in April, and then the busy season starts in May and June.
Okay, so tell me what that looks like when someone comes to Shasta Mountain Guides. What does that look like when they say, hey, take me up the mountain?
So what's great about Mount Shasta is its appeal is a wide range of climbers, from first-timers, rank beginners, to seasoned mountaineers training for perhaps bigger objectives. So many of our guests, many of our climbers, are first-time mountaineers. And for those of us who are living in this area, we look at Mount Shasta almost daily. And for some people, they're really inspired to climb to the peak. So the best training, or the best way to prepare for this, is properly training and preparing for it. So when they reach out to us, we're going to introduce a training program and regime and talk about timing and season and the different routes that we're climbing. There's a lot that goes into this activity.
How long should you train before you step?
That's a great question. I often tell folks, depending where you're starting from, if you're an athlete, you know, you're coming, many people climbing Mount Shasta are coming as backpackers or trail runners, cyclists. So if you've got a good fitness base, a dedicated training program of usually 2 to 4 months. If you're less, if you're more of an office warrior and don't spend as much time in the outdoors, you know, 6 months to even a year, people need to train and prepare for it.
Wow. For novices like me, how do you define the difference between a standard hike, rock climbing, and true mountaineering?
You know, good question. Hiking, which a lot of us do, is typically takes place on developed trails. It's a relatively safer activity, especially if you're properly planned. Mountaineering, when you step into mountaineering, there are no trails to the summit of Mount Shasta. That's one of the big misconceptions. There's no easy route. We're entering terrain that is more technical. We require specialized equipment. We're climbing with crampons on our boots. Crampons, if you don't know, are sharp, spiky metal spikes that attach to the bottom of our boots so we can stay stable and anchored to the snow that we're climbing. We're using an ice axe for balance and stability, but also in the event that somebody slips and falls, we learn how to stop ourselves, self-arrest with an ice axe. We're climbing on snow and ice and scree and rock. Like I said, there are no trails to the summit. We're dealing with elevation. As we all know, as we get higher in elevation, the air gets thinner. There's less oxygen available to us. Navigation, we're dealing with weather. We're dealing with more technical terrain. So it really does take a fair bit of planning and preparation to do so safely. And I'll be honest, you know, mountaineering, there are inherent risks associated with mountaineering, climbing mountains, that we do our best to manage and mitigate, but we can't eliminate them completely. And that's a really important fact.
Well, it sounds dangerous. Any close calls?
I've been doing this for over 30 years. I've had a couple close calls, and through those experiences, you learn from that, you grow from that, and hopefully minimize that from happening in the future. And certainly as I get older too, my tolerance for risk is a lot lower than it was when I was in my 20s. And I think that's true for most of us. The very first time I climbed Mount Shasta was over 30 years ago, and that's probably the closest I've come to, you know,
making
really bad mistakes. And it came from poor planning. I climbed at a really bad time of the year.
What happened? Tell me.
So the very first time I attempted Mount Shasta, I did so in the month of November, which now, as I know, was the absolute worst time to climb the mountain. And the reason for that, there's very little snow on the mountain on the normal route, Avalanche Gulch. One of the hazards with mountaineering, especially in the Cascades, and all mountains in general, is in the form of rockfall. These Cascade Mountains, they are decomposing piles of rock. And when the snow is melted and gone, naturally occurring rockfall just happens. They come tumbling down the mountain. And it was actually Thanksgiving Day, and I was climbing the mountain, and there was constant rockfall, just a barrage of rocks. And I was all day just dodging them left and right. And one came so close, I had to quickly move my head to the side, and it passed right over my shoulder, and I had really long hair at the time. It hit my ponytail as I dodged to the left, and I was 20-something years old, and I thought, well, this is just part of the game. And I realize now if I had planned better and chosen a more appropriate time of year, I could have greatly minimized that hazard.
Oh, you were in that invincible age.
Absolutely.
Does time of day matter, or can you leave at 10 o'clock in the morning at Bunny Flat?
Oh, great question, Jen. Timing is essential for climbing, both to minimize those risks that we're talking about, but also to give ourselves plenty of time. Summit day for most people is generally 12 to 14 hours of movement. And we don't want to get back to the trailhead after dark. We want to get back to the trailhead with enough time to go and have a pizza or a burger and a cold drink afterwards. But also it reduces our hazards. And like I said, 12 to 14 hours. So we're generally starting our summit climb 1 a.m., 2 a.m. and climbing by headlamp.
How do you teach people to recognize when not to go?
Oh boy, there's so many factors to consider, from time of year to time of day to which route is appropriate. So it really is. I consider it's a lifelong learning curve. And as I've already said, this activity is dangerous. And every time we go out is an opportunity to learn new things about yourself, about the activity, to find what's appropriate and manage your level of risk. And that's what's different for everybody. Our priority, of course, with our company, but also in general, is safety first. And that means we don't always reach the summit. Sometimes we turn around due to these hazards, due to poor weather, whiteout conditions, et cetera. So as I often tell folks, the mountain's not going anywhere. Yes, it's a volcano. Hopefully it doesn't erupt anytime soon, but it'll be around. You can come back and try it again.
How big is that mountain?
The summit of Mount Shasta is 14,179 feet, starting from the town of 3,500 feet. It's got over 11,000 feet of vertical relief, which is one of the largest reliefs in North America. But a really interesting fact about Mount Shasta, it's the largest peak by volume. Almost 85 cubic miles of material make up Mount Shasta. It's the largest peak in the United States, which people don't realize. But it is the first lesson you learn. And what I learned when I first climbed it is how big it is. When you look at a feature in the distance and you think, oh, it might take me 30 minutes or an hour to get to, and you realize 4 hours later and you're still not there. And that's the big lesson.
Wow. Well, you're listening to JX Outside on the Jefferson Exchange. Our outdoor guides are Nicole Larson and Jen Bray. Ray Pettengill is not here, but he's normally here. Also joining us is Chris Carr, owner of Shasta Mountain Guides. And we're talking about the experience of mountaineering. And I understand that there's this climb against the odds on Mount Shasta event. Has anybody done that?
I have actually climbed against the odds three different times. It's where I first started mountaineering in 2012. I still have some of the gear that we were issued. And I worked with Chris and Jen, and their guidance brought us safely to the summit. And the cool thing about climb against the odds is you can climb for your own personal rewards, or you can come as the local climber. And what the local climber does is every cent that you raise for the Breast Cancer Prevention Partners stays in the local area for breast cancer services. So it's a tremendous honor to be chosen as the local climber.
Okay, so what happens when you climb against the odds? How long does it take? What are you doing? Are you by yourself? Are you in tandem? Give me a sense. Take me onto the mountain. Paint me a picture.
Well, my first experience, like I said, was in 2012. And what really happens is you come into a family, because I've grown very close with the organizers in San Francisco from Breast Cancer Prevention Partners, and Chris and Jen and I have continued a conversation this whole time, so 14 years later. But every year is different, like you said, and you realize that every fundraiser and every person that participates is doing it for certain reasons, whether you have experienced cancer yourself and you're in remission. I've stood on the summit with two women that were 10 years in remission and one was 5 years in remission. And standing up there with them is an experience that I will take with me everywhere. I haven't had my personal, myself, involved in any cancer scares, thank goodness, but I know cancer has affected us all in some way, shape, or form.
Well, give me a sense. I'm not sure if you're a mountaineering person normally, but give me a sense of what does it take to get to the summit? Where do you start? How long does it take? And what are some of the challenges along the way?
Well, it starts really early, before June. Like Chris said, the training is extensive, and you go on these training hikes with people in your area, and sometimes the coordinators will come to you to organize other hikes so you can prep and see how it is. But when you come together for the week of June, there's the initial meeting of everybody and getting the reasons why you're climbing out. But there's also the ceremony where we plant seeds, and we tell the story of what this seed represents. And so not only does it grow while you're on the mountain, but it continues to grow in the organizer's office as a reminder of we're all going through some kind of growth, you know, and what do we want to present to the table in this great organization. And like I said, it becomes a family. And we initially started calling it Cry Against the Odds because it's so emotional, but it's welcome. You know, it's okay to feel heavy things because it's an emotional deal. It's like it affects all of us.
And how long does it take to get, once you start, how long does it take for the group to get to the top?
Well, every group is different. I think my first experience, we left our base camp. Well, we left Bunny Flat and we hiked to the base camp. And then we do some snow school and make sure that we can glissade safely and self-arrest and things like that. And I'm sure Chris can go into the details of those things more than I could. But then you get up at 1 o'clock in the morning and you are tied together at a certain elevation for safety and the crampons go on. And if you need assistance, the guides are so wonderful in helping you because you're kind of nervous, you know. But then it's just one step at a time. And it's slow. It's a methodical pace. And it's really a great experience to see the sun coming up behind Shasta and the shadow going to where it looks like Sacramento. It's just tremendous. And to be up there so high and see Castle Craigs, which are normally huge, they're just dwarfed. It's just the whole experience is magical.
And is it snowing up there all the time?
Generally, yes. We need snow to climb Mount Shasta. As I mentioned earlier, the snow makes for more efficient travel, it mitigates some of those hazards like rockfall. Like I said, the volcanoes, it's snow is necessary to climb to the top. And, you know, just to kind of paint a bigger picture, too, this is a multi-day event. I talked about, you know, 14 to 15-hour summit day, but that's the final day. There's 2 days to get to base camp, walking and covering those miles. As Jen said, we're teaching a snow school, so everybody's familiar with the specialized equipment that we're using, how to use it efficiently and safely. And then the big day, summit day, is that long, extended time on our feet.
Okay.
And also, Chris, what are you carrying? I mean, you're not just walking up there. It's not simple like, you know, running. You know, you don't just have shoes and shorts. What are you carrying on your back?
Great question. You know, what's so interesting about climbing Mount Shasta is it can go from the hottest of hot in the lower mountain to the coldest of cold on the upper mountain. So we're dressing and we're bringing with us layers to deal with whatever weather conditions, temperatures that we might see. Even in the middle of the summertime, even in June, July, and August, it can be below freezing. The wind can be blowing in the upper mountain. So we've got big puffy layers. We've got hats and ski gloves and mountaineering glasses. It's the range of weather that we see is extreme, and we have to be prepared for that. Have the right equipment. Nutrition is huge. It's not like a 5 mile run. We've got to be constantly eating and fueling the fire because, like I said, all that time on our feet, it's one thing to bonk on a run or on a bike ride, but you can't do that on the side of a mountain.
Now, I understand, as we have to end this show in a few seconds here, I understand you have an upcoming talk scheduled. Tell us more, Chris.
I am doing a presentation at the Mount Shasta Museum coming up on June 11th. This is part two of the history of mountaineering on Mount Shasta. Michael Zanger and Jack Moore did the first part last year, and Nick Myers, who's one of the lead climbing rangers on Mount Shasta with the U.S. Forest Service, we're doing part two here coming up June 11th.
Okay, that's all the time we have. Thank you all.
Thank you.